Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In late November, a snowy owl from the Arctic Circle made landing in Marietta, Ohio. And sometime soon after, its right wing sustained an injury that limited its flight. The owl sought something unusual in its fight for survival, human civilization. We're going to talk about that and more delights of winter birding today. Joining us by phone is naturalist, artist, and author Julie Zickafoos. We'll post a link to her blog at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome back, Julie.
Hi, it's so great to be back, Ann. Thank you.
You were just leaving for Ecuador when the snowy owl was spotted atop a Lowe's hardware store in Marietta, which is right by your, you know, where you live in southern Ohio. Tell us, I mean, you were leaving, you were thinking, hey, you know, that's the way it goes. You're headed to Ecuador to go birding. You know, life's
right,
good. Life
right.
is good.
I thought, you know, I'm going to be seeing long-tailed sylphs and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's all going to be good. I'll be looking at blue toucans, and so I'll just have to let this one go. And this owl quickly flew down Route 77 south and wound up at the Emerson Avenue exit in West Virginia. And there it lived for about a week, and a lot of birders saw it. It didn't show a whole lot of sense. It was sometimes photographed on the road on Emerson Avenue. But it would usually sit atop highway signs, and it was hunting mice around the Burger King up there. And then it disappeared on December 6th, and nobody could find it. I went to look for it, couldn't find it. And then it mysteriously showed up again, and we know this because it had the same markings, exact same markings as the owl that was at Emerson Avenue. It appeared 4 miles distant in the middle of the Grand Central Mall. And that was December 14th, and the bird was there for 8 days. And I was reluctant to go see it because I knew I would get emotionally involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know until I saw it that this bird was badly injured.
It was one of the most unusual aspects of this whole thing is how close it let people get to it.
Right.
And that distressed you.
Yes. Yes. I watched it for 6.5 hours on December 18th. And I divided my time between asking people nicely to please back off and photographing it. And then I began photographing the interactions between the owl and the people.
Mm-hmm.
And I left that evening as it got dark, and I was just exhausted because I had been putting out so much psychic energy, you know, trying to keep this bird safe and worrying about it because nobody else had seemed to pick up on the fact that its right wing was hanging low. And I noticed when it flew that it wasn't using the wing right. So I got very, very concerned about the bird. And I sensed that its unnatural tameness was just that, that it was unnatural. And Bill Thompson of Birdwatchers Digest got busy on the phone, and he lined up the rehabilitator Katie Fallon of the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia, which is located in Morgantown, and he asked if Katie would be willing to take the bird on should it be captured. And I went home that night and started writing a blog post about the owl and asking people to please respect its space and to give it some room. And a bunch of people sort of went into motion when that post came up saying, this owl is injured, it needs help. And we were very quietly arranging its capture and transport to a rehab facility the whole time.
My guest is Julie Zickafoos, longtime friend of All Sides. She's a naturalist, artist, author, and blogger. We'll have a link to her blogs on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We're talking about the snowy owl that landed first in Marietta, Ohio, and then across the river in West Virginia. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So how did they capture the owl?
That was really pretty cool. There is a known way of capturing large raptors, and it's called a bow net. And you set this net, which is like a big clamshell, spring-loaded, and you put live bait in the middle of it, in this case a gerbil, and the owl comes down to get it, and you pull a string, and the net claps over the bird. This turned out not to be what we had to do. The owl ignored the bow net and ignored the bait And so a cannon net was set, which is sort of another level up in wildlife trapping. This is an explosive charge loaded net that when triggered gives a big bang and throws these three padded projectiles out into the air and drops an enormous net over the bird.
Mm-hmm.
So that failed to deploy.
Okay.
And what wound up happening was Jesse Fallon, the veterinarian of the ACCA, the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia, wound up sneaking up on it, just like Elmer Fudd, with a big pole net and clapping the net down over the bird, and he got it. But that was after about 7 hours of steady waiting by a group of people who were very, very invested in seeing this bird taken care of.
Let's talk about the snowy owl for a minute. Now, I remember last year there were a lot of them that came through Ohio, and it was a thing.
Actually, the big invasion was the winter of 2013-14.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, and that was one where we had many, many, many owls in the state. I think there were 35 or so reported from around the state.
Okay.
I may be wrong about that, but there were a lot of owls. And generally, we get snowy owls up around the shore of Lake Erie every year, one or two.
Okay.
But in an invasion year, like 13, 14, and 17, 18, we get a bunch of them. We get dozens. And it's just been fabulous. There are snowy owls all over the place. They tend to gravitate to the lakeshore, as I said, and also to Amish country, Holmes County, Adams County, that kind of. They like the agricultural fields. They're looking for something that looks vaguely like tundra, because that's where they're from.
And one of the reasons why we have these explosions of snowy owls is because there's an explosion of lemmings, which is their main food up in the Arctic Circle?
Exactly. It's really, really interesting. For a long time, it was thought that these hordes of snowy owls coming south were starving and that they were just going anywhere they could to try to find food. What we now know is that a snowy owl invasion year follows a prolific lemming year. A lemming is a little rodent, a little smaller than a beer can. It's like a vole, very short ears, short tail. Vole is a type of mouse.
Mm-hmm.
And they explode in the Arctic. And in years like that, in the summer, the snowy owls will actually ring their nests with piles of lemmings. Like, I can provide for these chicks. And when the female snowy owl gets a load of that and gets all that food, she starts to lay lots of eggs. And a female snowy owl can lay as many as 13 eggs, which is a whole lot of baby owls. But if they have unlimited prey, they can feed them all. And so you get these tremendous production years of snowy owls. And then what happens in the fall when food gets scarce is the resident owls say, I'm staying here.
Mm-hmm.
You can leave. And they chase the young ones out.
And they have the strength to make it.
And they do. And when they're captured, they're often fat as butter,
mm-hmm,
and very healthy. And what's really neat is there's a project called Project Snowstorm,
yeah,
which was the brainchild of my dear friend Scott Weidensahl, among others. And he's a Pulitzer Prize nominated author, author of Living on the Wind, incredible books, just an amazing writer. Anyway, Scott has been trapping and banding snowy owls and putting little geotransmitter packs on their backs at the tune of $3,000 per pack.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's not cheap, but neither is it the space program. This is a very low-cost way to find out fabulous things about birds we know nothing about.
And I mean, you know, these it's all connected. I mean, these lemming explosions,
mm-hmm,
are coming from something, and that's probably some kind of climate change that enables them to feed better.
It makes you wonder. I will say that snowy owl eruptions have been going on for millions of years.
Right.
So
it's from
it's
season to season. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But the fact that we're getting so many so close, it does kind of make you wonder if it's linked at all to global warming.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the kind of data that we need to gather in order to answer questions like that.
So you've mentioned two groups, the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia and then the group studying the snowy owls.
Yes.
Both of them are supported by donations, right?
Completely. You know, in this in this climate. This is how research and especially wildlife rehabilitation get done, through private donation. And ACCAWV.org is the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia's website. They are currently taking care of the owl, and this thing eats about 200 grams of chicks, frozen mice, every day, and is gaining weight like crazy and is doing wonderfully and has just been transferred to a bigger cage. But, you know, costs a lot of money to give these things x-rays and the expensive medications they need. And Project Snowstorm is funded entirely by donation, and it is one of the most elegant projects I've ever seen. It's basically a few people out there networking, trapping snowy owls, putting solar-powered geotransmitters on their back. Negligible weight, doesn't bother the owl one bit. And these transmitters, will powered by the sun, will download data to satellites whenever the bird is in range of a cell signal. So what's so cool is these snowy owls can go clear up to the Arctic, have a nesting season, raise their young. Nobody knows what they're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the next time they come south and get within range of a cell tower, you know, south of the Arctic Circle, all these data points download and or upload, I'm not sure which is the term, and we suddenly have this gigantic bank of data on what this owl has been doing for the past 3 or 4 months, right? So every half hour, its location is transmitted. And this little transmitter can store all this information until the owl comes within range of a cell tower.
Now,
it's just incredible. So they make these maps, these colorful maps on the ProjectSnowstorm.org website that show us what these birds do.
In all likelihood, the snowy owl that was captured recently and is being cared for by the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia probably was healthy at one point. It became injured. It ran into a truck or something?
Well, it actually got hit flying off a very low wall at a Burger King at the Emerson Avenue exit on I-77. And we did not know that until the bird showed up at the mall, and there were some personnel from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service there doing crowd control, because as you can imagine, when Hedwig shows up at the Grand Central Mall, there's quite a kerfuffle, and people get very excited and all crowd around wanting to see this bird. So there were some people from the Ohio River Islands National Wildlife Refuge there doing crowd control, and one of them, Michael Schramm, was keeping people back, and a fellow came up and said, "I got to confess, I hit that bird about a week ago." And he showed Michael the bumper of his car in which were embedded the feathers of a snowy owl. So tightly embedded that nobody could pull them out.
Wow.
So this bird hit with a tremendous amount of force.
Yeah.
And we now know through x-rays that broke the coracoid strut of the breastbone of the bird.
Which doesn't mean a lot to me. Can you describe it?
Sure. If you think of the breastbone, well, you know when you carve a turkey, you've got that great big keel, that big breastbone that all the meat comes off of.
Right.
That's what we're talking about.
Okay.
And
oh,
in birds, there is a strut that strengthens that, and it actually makes it possible for the bird to do a downstroke. It supports the muscle, the big pectoral muscle that powers the wing. So that got broken, and what resulted was a snowy owl with a very unstable right shoulder, a lot of pain, and limited power of flight. And that was what I witnessed when I saw the bird on December 14th. Did not know it had been hit by a car, but knew something very bad had happened to it. And so that's what set all these wheels in motion to get it into care, was the photos I took of the bird in flight that show that it wasn't using its wing properly.
We will continue our conversation about the snowy owl of Marietta, Ohio / West Virginia when we return to our conversation with Julie Zickefoose. So stay with us. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Writer, artist, and naturalist Julie Zicafus headed south for Ecuador in late November, just as a snowy owl landed on the rooftop of a big box store in Marietta, Ohio. She thought she would miss the show, but the same owl hung around and sometime in early December sustained an injury to its right wing. It ended up across the river in West Virginia. Julie Zicafus is still with us to talk about what happened to the snowy owl. Julie, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You wrote that the miracle of this owl is that it lives at all. The setting couldn't be worse between the traffic and the onlookers and also poisoned prey.
Who actually knew that every restaurant sets out back a bait box full of rodenticide?
I didn't either.
And until I started looking around where this owl was hanging out, which was a channelized ditch that flows through the Grand Central Mall in Vienna, West Virginia, I didn't realize that behind every restaurant is a little box, and in that box is usually something like warfarin, which is an anticoagulant rodenticide that causes internal bleeding, and that when a raptor takes a rodent that has eaten that, it dies too. So that's something to think about. Rodenticide use is prevalent. It's everywhere, and it's actually policy at restaurants to use these
because now, they have health codes to watch.
Because they, yes, so let's think about that. Do the restaurant managers all want to use that? Heck no, you know. Mm-hmm. But they're made to, and so that was another bit of education. There is actually a Facebook group about this called Raptors Are the Answer, RATS, talking about the dangers of rodenticides and supplementary kill. And so I've learned so much from this bird. But
yeah.
A lot of what I've learned is sort of in the realm of the metaphysical, and I hope we'll get to that too.
Yeah, I do definitely want to get to that.
Yeah.
But first, why didn't it eat more of these rodents that are attracted to these fast food places?
Boy, really hard to say.
Yeah.
When I saw the bird foraging, it was plunging into the grass, and it was sorting around. A lot of people saw it capturing voles, which eat weed seeds. They would not be attracted to restaurant dumpsters.
Okay.
And the blood panel that came back on the bird was negative for anticoagulants, so thank goodness.
Yeah, right.
Because it would have had an even tougher row to hoe. But I think that rodenticides are a major cause of death of snowy owls, red-tailed hawks, lots of hawks that eat rodents, and tend to frequent places where people are.
So we could just let them do their job.
Yeah. More red tails, less warfarin. How about that?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Let's talk, you know, it didn't have to be there. Would it have been safer, all things being equal, in the wild?
Well, yes. And this is where it gets so interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody knows why a snowy owl decides to sit at a highway exit sitting on road signs, you know. But the very weird thing is that after it got hit, it made its way somehow to the most populated area of Vienna, West Virginia, and there it sat. And that was what really moved me and what got me thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started thinking about this owl the moment I laid eyes on it on December 18th, and I have not stopped thinking or writing about it since. And I had to draw back on some of my own experiences in wildlife rehabilitator since about 19, oh my gosh, I won't even say, but I was probably 8 when I started really working on birds. I lived next door to a woman who had 17 cats and allowed them to hunt just in our yard in the woods. And so I forever had orphan birds. I had baby birds that had been knocked out of the nest. I had birds with broken wings that I was trying to fix as a little kid. Beautiful part of that is I managed to convince this woman to get all her animals spayed and put them all inside.
Mm.
And that would have been about 1971.
Way before your time, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. On the cutting edge.
Yeah.
So fast forward. I've been doing wildlife rehab a long time, and I have come across some stories and some situations where it seemed to me irrefutable that the animals had come to humanity seeking help. And I think the most moving story was told by my friend Charlie Kennedy, who was at the time, he told me, the president of the Alabama Ornithological Society. He had been out gardening in his wooded yard in Alabama, and he heard a screech of brakes and a thump. And not long thereafter, a turkey vulture came up his driveway dragging a wing. And Charlie said, "Oh, I'm sorry about that, old son. I can't help you. Why don't you go off into the woods? I can't do anything for you." And the turkey vulture wouldn't take no. And it followed him into a tool shed, and then it followed him up the steps into his kitchen. And Charlie called a wildlife rehab center and took the bird there, where it unfortunately died, but not before teaching a very powerful lesson mm-hmm. about a bird in need and what it might do. So I got to thinking about the fact that a turkey vulture is by nature a scavenger, and all it has to do is find a dead possum, and it's all set. What about a snowy owl that has to outwit its prey, that by Project Snowstorm's findings has been recorded sitting on sea channel markers and buoys and at night taking sleeping ducks off the water? This is kind of cool. These mm-hmm. birds are doing things that we have no concept of. So what about a really smart apex Arctic predator who suddenly gets a broken wing and goes, "Uh-oh, I am cooked"? What does it do? It goes to a mall and sits on the ground and lets people walk right up to it. Why does it do that? You answer that.
To attract attention?
Possibly. I'm just submitting that.
Yeah.
It's atypical behavior, and I'm haunted by it. So the beautiful thing that's been happening on my blog is that people have been sharing their own stories of animals seeking help. And it's pretty moving stuff, you know? Someone just sent me a video this morning of a wild raven that sat on someone's fence line and cawed and cried for about an hour until they went out, and it had porcupine quills in its face. And in the video, this woman with gloves on is gingerly removing the quills, and the raven just sits there and lets her do it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool stuff. There's a lot of this. There's a lot of this.
You posit that perhaps it's passed down or it's shared among the species that humans can help.
Well, yeah, and that centers on another story told by my friend Christine, who she found a rabbit lying under a cherry tree in her yard, and it was near death, and it was covered with these big bumps that are caused by something called warble flies. Warble flies lay their eggs on rabbit skin, and they make a big old larva that then burrows under the skin and makes this enormous, very painful lump. And this rabbit was absolutely covered. So Christine and her husband held the rabbit and tweezed out all the larvae. And the rabbit was so traumatized and so weak that they left it lying in their bathtub on towels overnight with food and water, and it fully expected to find it dead in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But the morning, it was just ricocheting off the walls of the bathroom. So they managed to catch it with some difficulty and let it go. And that same week, two different rabbits approached them and let them pick them up and take the warbles out from under their skin.
Isn't that something?
I get chills.
Yeah.
Christina's full of stories like this, and I adore her. And I've been collecting stories from people. Someone just offered something they had seen on the TV news about a dog that got hit by a car and his paw was run over. And he walked to the veterinary office where he was treated, where his owner would take him. And he waited until someone came in. They let the dog in the door, and he came up to the front desk and held up his paw. You got to love it.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, yeah. He probably went to the weight machine and got weighed first, you know?
Yeah, right.
If it would have been there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of amazing. It's an old story, though.
Androcles and the lion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a very old story.
It's a very old story. And I guess what I'm hoping is that people will accept the possibility that these old stories are still very much in effect and have power and will be more sentient, will be more tuned in to animals and not automatically assume that the stupid snowy owl went to the mall and sat on the ground because it was too dumb to know any better, right?
Exactly. And I can't think of anything yuckier looking than a vulture, a turkey vulture. When I hear, I know. But when I hear Charlie's story, it just makes me all soft and fuzzy.
Well, I'll tell you, I had my own story. I'm driving along through Whipple Flats on my way home. I live in southeast Ohio near Marietta. And I saw a vulture standing by the side of the road with its head hanging down. And I did, of course, the quick check as I whizzed by. No prey in sight. You know, there wasn't a dead animal there.
Mm-hmm.
So I pulled over. And I walked back to it, and the bird didn't move. And I knelt down beside it, and I said, "What's the matter, hon?" And it just looked at me. It just rolled its eye. And I reached out and picked it up, and it was so thin, it was just like gathering up a bundle of feathers and bones. And I took it home on my lap, and that bird wouldn't eat anything I laid out for it unless I fed it from my fingers. Never seen a bird act like that.
Yeah.
And I fed it and fed it, and it got stronger and stronger, still well, way too weak to fly. So I punted to the experts at the Ohio Wildlife Center right there off Billingsley Road on the Sawmill Road exit on 270 in Columbus,
mm-hmm.
in Worthington, right? And they took it on and fed it and examined it, and the only thing they could find was it was emaciated. You know, we don't know why. But it plumped back up, and they released it. So there's the question. Why was it standing by the road with its head hanging down? Was it waiting for Julie Zickafoos to come home from town? I don't know. I don't give myself that much credit, but I do wonder if it was just waiting for someone to notice that it was in bad shape.
Wow. You knew a blue jay. You still do.
I do.
And
I do.
You formed a special relationship with a blue jay last year. First, let's hear a bit of what a blue jay sounds like before we talk about Jemima Jay. I'm more familiar with the screechy sound.
Yeah, you mean the predator call. Right. Yeah, I can't listen to anything a jay says without this huge smile because I just love them so much. I'm looking at two right now, right outside my window. Jemima was a bird who was found on a sidewalk in Marietta and given to me on May 16th of this past year. And I raised and saved her a couple different times. And she became a family member and then was released on June 11th. And it has now been, this is day 15 of seeing no Jemima.
Yeah,
it's hard. I'm very wrapped up in this bird, and I love her way too much. But she is a wild thing, and she has her jay friends that she goes around with. So I just have to be okay with her coming home every now and then.
We have some jays that visit our yard on a regular basis. Is it safe to assume it's the same ones returning to the feeders?
Well, I can answer that with some authority, at least for my area, no. I have three different groups of jays that seem to circulate in here. And with this latest polar vortex, I had a group of 13 come in who I did not know. I think they came from farther north. And they seem to have displaced Jemima's group, which went I know not where.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been amusing myself photographing these 13 for, you know, as long as it's been cold, which was, I last saw Jemima Christmas Eve morning, which was the best present I could have. And then she took off and these other jays came in. So the cycle has, I hope, run its course, and I hope to see my girl again before too long. But, the way I could tell was they were completely different. I've been watching these jays so long that I know their faces,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly I was seeing strange jays who were doing things that my resident jays didn't do. So it's unscientific, I know, but everything I do is unscientific.
But it's natural. Is it safe to assume that if Jemima's with another group that she's better off?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
I think the social system of blue jays is the only reason she has survived. I just Cliff's Notes version, Jemima came to me very sick, and I cured her of this disease with antibiotics, but it left its mark in feathers that were weakened and broke off, so mm-hmm. she flies very poorly. But she still hangs with this group of seven jays and somehow keeps up with them in the woods and makes travels and returns. And if you could see this bird fly, you'd never believe that she had survived since June, you know, flying around in the woods with barely any feathers.
The photo that you provided to us, thank you so much, by the way, of the blue jay in the snow for our website, and I highly recommend people get a load of this photograph. It's beautiful. But is that one of the group that during the vortex?
Yes, this is one of the Canadian jays. I'm assuming they're from way farther north. I call that bird Worried Mind because it has a little line over its eye that makes it look worried.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's Worried Mind. And he's one of the 13, or she. Hard to tell the sex. Only way you can tell a sex of a jay is if you happen to see it emit a male or female specific call.
Ha. Huh. So what were we hearing earlier besides the screech?
We were hearing the JJ call, which is the alarm call, the sort of eh, eh. And then we heard the skeedlerp call, which is my name for it.
Teedlerp, yeah.
Yeah, also called a bell call. And that's emitted by both sexes.
Okay.
However, there is a male-specific call, and I know this because of a fabulous woman from Newfoundland who refers to herself as Leslie the Bird Nerd.
I love that.
Oh, my gosh. You have to check out Leslie. She spells her name L-E-S-L-E-Y.
Okay.
And Leslie has a group of jays that she has been hand-feeding for 6 years, and she knows them cold. She knows she has each one named, and she's figured out, well, ornithology had partway figured this out, but she's figured out that there's a couple of calls that are specific. One is the male jay is the only one that gives what she calls the squeaky gate call, which is very seldom heard. I've heard it 4 times since I started studying jays intensively. And it's a high, thin, shrieking sort of, and then 2 octaves lower, very strange sort of, very weird call. Like you hear it and you think, what just did that?
Yeah, I've heard, yeah.
Yeah, you probably heard it.
Yeah.
They do it a lot in the spring and fall.
Okay.
And if you can see the bird that gives the call and somehow notice its facial markings and distinguish it from the others, then you've got a certified male. And the female gives something that's called the growl, which is it's like a low rattle, very guttural. And she bobs up and down in the cutest way as she gives it. And I have seen some of our jays give that. So I'm very slowly teasing out the sexes of the jays that travel with Jemima.
And Jemima, you know, a lot of people wonder how you avoid domesticating a young bird like that.
Sure.
What were some of the things you took care to do? And by the way, this is not something you do at home, folks.
Yeah, I should add that I've been licensed as a wildlife rehabilitator since about 1982.
Yeah.
State and federal permits to do this, and I'm really not fooling around. I'm studying these birds as I do this. But that said, I raise them in my house, and because that's the facility that I have,
mm-hmm.
and I also use an outdoor flight tent. But I quickly found out with Jemima that the flight tent was tantamount to solitary confinement to her, and she hated it, and she refused to eat when she was in the tent. So I continued to raise her in the house, even though it was rather messy, and I decided that she would figure out if she was a jay on her own, and in fact, she did. One of the things that I did from a very early age was play her all the vocalizations of blue jays. And she showed intense interest in those because she was 11 days old when I got her.
Mm-hmm.
She knew them, and she knew she was a jay. She sat in the kitchen on the back of a chair often when she was very young, and I kept peanuts on the railing right outside the kitchen window so she could see jays come and go. Kept the windows open. She could hear them. They showed interest in her. She showed interest in them. And aside from that, you know, we fed her and raised her and loved her. And when time came to release her, she found the group immediately.
Mm-hmm.
and bonded with another juvenile that we named Maybelline before I heard him give the squeaky gate call.
right.
And that's how I figured out that Jemima was, in fact, a female.
Okay.
So yeah, Maybelline and Jemima are a unit and have been since they were a matter of weeks old. And that's one of the great gifts of having raised her is this portal she's given me into Blue Jay Society. It's amazing. And I was just thinking how much I'd like to raise another one.
If you have a question or comment for Julie Zicafoos, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Still with us, naturalist, artist, author, and blogger Julie Zicafoos. We'll have a link to her blog on our website at WOSU.org. You can enjoy some of her beautiful photography if you go to our website and check out the beautiful photograph of a blue jay in winter. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Marianne, Julie. She writes, I have the usual birds visiting my backyard feeders, but there's a wren who prefers to forage on my porch, poking into fake wicker furniture, peering up at old spider webs, pecking along the windowsills. Mm-hmm. What's up with that?
Oh, what's up with that is you need to make some Zicto and feed that wren.
I have Zicto now.
Good. Yeah, just Google Zicto Improved. That's Z as in zebra, I-C-K-D-O-U-G-H. Zicto Improved. It's a mix you can make for insectivores like Carolina wrens. And as I speak, there are some birds, titmice, eating it in a little feeder by my window right now. The Carolina wren is looking for dormant insects. It's looking for larvae. It's looking for houseflies that have poked themselves into little crevices. And, you know, they also frequent outbuildings, houses, porches, that kind of thing. That's where they live. And every year we get them in our garage, and my son will say, oh, there's a couple wrens trapped in the garage. And I'm like, no, not trapped. They figured out how to get in, probably through a mouse hole, and they are happy as clams in there, eating spiders and beetles and everything.
We have the Carolina wren song. They're small brown birds, but the males have a loud voice.
Yes.
Here's a bit of the big song that comes from this small bird.
I can hear people all over Ohio going, so that's what that is.
Exactly.
And here's the cool thing about Carolina wrens. They are a member of the genus Triatoris, which is a large genus in the tropics, and we just get a few up here. But these wrens are distinguished by staying in pairs year-round, a very endearing habit to us humans, and they also duet. So they will sing. You'll often hear a duet of the birds. One bird sings maybe tweedle, and the other one goes doot. And this will come like in stereo from two different places.
Uh-huh.
And so the female has a very powerful voice as well, and she sings as well.
Can birds throw their voices?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, yeah.
I've started to wonder about that a few times, and okay.
Well, they have a number of frequencies, and especially sibilancies, that allow them to make a sound that's very, very hard to locate. And most of the predator alert calls are very soft and sibilant, like the towhee has a sort of a call that it does. Very hard to locate because it's so it has so many overtones. So you can't really zero in on it. And that is designed to warn other birds, the predators in the area, but to make the bird that's calling it to protect it from being
right, without
detected.
Disclosing their own location.
Exactly. Right,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. Larry in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Larry.
No, it's Jim.
Oh, sorry, Jim.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm enjoying the conversation. Going back a little bit, Julie talking about her professional certifications. Now, my question goes to, are there any educational programs, like in 1 or 2 year schools that could teach this type of animal rescue?
You know, probably your best thing to do would be to contact the Ohio Wildlife Center and ask if you might enroll for some of their courses in wildlife rehab. There's a lovely woman named Barbara Ray, from whom I took a course on handling rabies vector animals, and it was a full-day course held at a very nice state park lodge. And when I came out, I had a piece of paper that certified me as a rabies animal handler. Now, you do have to apply for a permit from both the state and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in order to do this kind of wildlife work. But the Ohio Wildlife Center can point you toward the right places to learn how to do this.
Actually, we had an email from Gregory who wrote, maybe you could post a link to the Ohio Wildlife Center. I've taken injured rabbits there. They also take birds. So we'll do that. We'll post a link to the Ohio Wildlife Center for folks on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Meanwhile, Gregory says that separately, we had an encounter with some screech owls in our backyard during the 4th of July near Whetstone. They make the most god-awful shriek or hiss, but yeah. I was glad to have seen them. They do hiss, right?
Yeah, well, baby screech owls have a very rasping sort of a eek. It just sounds terrible, like someone strangling someone. And, yeah, and when they are just out of the nest, they make a really awful sound. But the adult screech owl has a very soft whinny. It's beautiful little descending kind of call like that, and very pleasant, mellow.
Nancy in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Ann. Hey, Julie. How are you?
I'm good.
This is your you know who I am, Nancy.
I please. Do.
Yes. That's great traveling with this gal, in case anybody has never had that privilege.
Please can't imagine,
it.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Julie, I'm having a lot of jays in the yard all of a sudden, and I'm wondering, what's the best way to feed them?
Well,
what do they really prefer?
This is funny, because Jemima's group is ignorant of peanuts in the shell. They don't know about them, and so I can throw peanuts in the shell out there, and they'll go ignored. The Canadian group that came in later is all about the peanuts in the shell.
Hmm.
So it depends on the cultural bent of the group, but peanuts out of the shell, like cocktail peanuts, are a delicacy for jays. Be sure and get them unsalted.
I was going to ask, yeah.
Yes, and I buy them in bulk. Actually, some of the better stores will have them in bulk. But, yeah, peanuts are a sure hit with jays, but they also adore whole corn. And that's a very low-cost thing that you can give to jays.
Whole corn. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Great.
Thanks, Nancy.
Well, thank you so much.
You bet. Anyone else has a question or comment for Julie Zicafoos, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Julie, one of our big achievements this year is we've been able to attract a group of bluebirds.
Oh, wow.
I know. And we thought the first time, I said, there was a bluebird out there. And then I thought, well, it's a fluke. We had thistle out and in a sock, and it wasn't a fluke. And we brought more and more back with mealworms, dried mealworms.
Oh, really? What time of year was this?
This, well, right now, except starlings like mealworms, too.
Yeah,
and we've attracted starlings, and they've kind of chased away the bluebirds, and we're bummed.
Yeah.
And tell us what—I know I've asked you this before, but tell us what to do.
Well, I like to do something I call snob feeding, where starlings are concerned. Now, you have to understand that starlings are like hobos, and they're very messy, and they poop on everything. However, they're very honest hobos. As soon as the ground unfreezes, they will leave, and they will go earn their living by digging grubs out of the soil. So pity the poor starling who can't get into the frozen ground right now. So anyway, what I do is I offer very, very nice treats like mealworms and, well, I don't feed mealworms personally, but that's a whole nother show. We can talk about that. Yeah. But I offer my Zicto in feeders that starlings are afraid to come to. And that would include small hanging plexiglass feeders right by my kitchen window.
Okay.
Where I can stare the birds in the eye and say booga 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 if a starling even tries. So that's my solution for it. The other, I also rigged up a little feeder right by my studio drawing board, protected by a plexiglass roof, uh-huh. right up against the window. And it keeps the snow off the food, and there I offer Zig dough and delicious peanuts, and only the cognoscenti come in there, like my Carolina wrens and my titmice and cardinals and chickadees. So think about proximity to places where you are frequently there, and places that a wild bird like a starling would be afraid to enter.
Okay, but that won't scare off other birds, too?
Well, basically, you've got to build up a sort of culture of using this feeder among your birds in the yard. And once they figure it out, see, bluebirds aren't afraid to go in things.
Yeah.
Neither are Carolina wrens. And in fact, I've got a Carolina wren right now pigging out in my little secret feeder by my studio. So if you do this long enough and the birds key into it, they will sort of transmit this culturally. And the starlings that swoop in the cold weather don't know to do this and would be afraid to come that close to you anyway.
Dana on the west side, you're on the air. Hi, Dana.
Hi. I just had a question. This is my first year putting bird feeders up, and I'm attracting different types of birds, which seems to be causing a little fighting. So I was wondering if it was a good idea to feed the birds in the winter, or did it make them become dependent?
That's a common question.
Yeah, it is. I thought, well, if people are still asking, go for it.
It's a really good question. Mm-hmm. I think we should remember that bird feeding benefits people. And I do it because I study birds all day long. And let's remember that Jane Goodall brought chimps in with bananas so she could study them. Had she not used bananas, she wouldn't have had any way to know about the social lives of chimpanzees. So I think that there is justification for feeding from the enjoyment that it gives people. However, there are downsides. As you mentioned, lots of birds in proximity can promote disease, and so we need to feed responsibly. We need to clean up the stuff under the feeders regularly. We need to clean our feeders with scrub brushes and bleach. I clean my bird bath every 2 days without fail, no matter the weather, with scrub brushes and bleach and hot soapy water, and then refill. I have an electric heated dog dish to offer water in winter. Really, really cheap, good way to give water. So it's really a personal choice. But when I see, like right now, I've got a flock of about 40 grackles underneath my spruce cleaning up this corn and seed that I've thrown under there.
Uh-huh.
And I know I'm helping them survive. And some people will say, well, those are just blackbirds. Well, grackles are on a long-term, non-cyclic decline throughout their range.
Grackles are people, too.
Grackles are people and grackle lives. Yeah, all that. So let's do that and take joy in it. It's incredible connection you can make to birds.
Speaking of grackles, we have an email. And by the way, Dana, thanks for that call. We have an email from Mark or Mayor who says, when the weather was so very cold, hovering near zero every day, where do all the birds get their water? We did see grackles eating snow.
Yeah, that's what they do. They eat snow, but that doesn't mean they don't get thirsty. And you should see the birds wait for me to come out and clean that bird bath, that plugs in. I've never been able to find a heated dog dish waterer that will last more than 2 years. And one of the things I'd love to do is split like a hydra and have one half become an entrepreneur.
Wow.
Who would market the perfect winter bird bath.
What a visualization there, Julie. Yeesh.
Like a hydra.
Yeah. Well, I want to say that, if you want to know more about the Zig dough, someone left some on my porch. Thank you, Wendy, a friend of mine, a neighbor and friend, left some for me on my porch for Christmas. And that was a really big treat. And I have some on a little feeder right by my window.
Right.
But if you want, you can go to Julie's blog, her website. We'll post a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And you can find the Zig dough recipe there still, right?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And the post is called Zig dough improved. And all you've got to do is Google those words and it'll take you to that post.
Zig dough improved. Well, uh-huh. Julie Zickafoos, what a joy to have you again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Total treat for me. Thank you so much for letting me blather.
Julie Zickafoos, naturalist, artist, author, blogger, many, many things. Not a hydra yet, though, thank God. God. Thanks for listening today to Julie Zicafus, and thanks for joining us on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.